forms on here. Oh, form is there.
Members, we have a full schedule today, so let's get started. Anybody had a chance to read the minutes? We have minutes from February 12th and February 17th. Oh, the quorum is present, excuse me. Representative Lewick, would you?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd move the minutes, both sets of minutes.
Okay, thank you. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Okay, minutes are moved. All right, we have no resolutions today, so we're going to get started right away. Mr. Knisley, am I rushing you? We can go ahead.
No, just start.
Okay. I believe we're going to hear first from Sarah Dornick. Is she here? There we go. Good morning, if you would like to state your name and for the record.
Hi, I'm Sarah Dornick. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Agricultural Education Leadership Council.
Thank you. Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Chair. Members of the committee, for those of you who don't know, MALC is a 17-member legislative council that started in 1997 to promote and expand agricultural education opportunities across the state of Minnesota. Our board is made up of six legislators, including three on your committee, Representative Poppy, Representative Anderson, and Chair Hamilton, as well as three senators, Senator Coonan, Senator Dames, and Senator Sparks. We also have two governor appointees and representatives from many bodies, including Department of Agriculture, Department of Education, the Minnesota Association of Agricultural Educators, FFA Foundation, the Minsky System, the University of Minnesota College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences, the Department of the Agricultural Education Program at the University, and the Minnesota Private College Council. Our staff is myself and my coworker, Carrie Schwab, who's the program assistant, so we're a pretty small shop. MALC has lots of key objectives that we really work towards, but there are pieces that we initiatives that we follow. Our first piece, of course, is to serve as a resource for you, the legislature, to provide policy recommendations, to answer any of your questions, and that's a role we take seriously, and of course, during this session and all year, we're here and available for you. The second piece is serving as a statewide leader for many of our initiatives. Many of you have heard of the teacher shortage in agriculture education. Minnesota was selected as one of 11 states to be part of a national pilot project that looks at recruitment and retention strategies for teachers. And MALC is serving as the state contact for our statewide committee. So that would be just one small example of an initiative that we're leading. But we have lots of statewide projects that we lead and bring together all the groups of agriculture education. And then the third piece, of course, is our grants program, which is part of our statute and what we're here to talk about today. I should reference our funding. Our operating budget comes through the agriculture special through the Higher Education Committee. And then this piece that is today is specifically just our grants program and special projects. And that runs through here as a pass-through through the Department of Agriculture to us. We run our grants program in two different programs. One is called Common Fund, which is decided in June. Those are our larger statewide and regional projects, which set up our fiscal year. It sets up our budget, and then we know how much is available for then our program grants, which are more locally based, and those are usually smaller amounts, and we have two rounds during the year for those grants. So I think, since you don't have it, you should have my PowerPoint in your packet. There is a common fund listing there, as you'll see. There's, if I cannot, oh, 1, 2, 3, 4. It'd be page slide 6 on your handout there. So that is the common funds that MALC approved this year. and so as you can see, that ranges from agricultural literacy projects, online curriculum. We have a statewide subscription for all agriculture teachers. The Bachelor of Science, many of you know, the University of Minnesota is currently the only institution that offers an agriculture education teaching license. Southwest Minnesota State University Marshall and the University of Minnesota Crookston are both looking at starting their own programs. And so this specific money was for a program director who had helped recruit and advise those students that want to consider that degree. And then the last one from the University of Minnesota is our teacher induction program, which is a mentorship program that we know has a phenomenal retention rate of ag teachers from their first year into the second year. Then you'll see on the next slide is our initiatives. We have many, our grants are called strategic initiatives. We focus on everything from ag literacy, starting and maintaining programs, pushing the envelope with new curriculum, recruiting and retaining instructors, and then also farm business management. The recipients, of course, are all over the board. Some of the hot topics that we've been seeing more recently are a lot of science projects relating to STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. And so we have three programs, the CART, which I mentioned, the statewide subscription. But then also we have College in the Schools. We partner with the University of Minnesota to offer an animal science and plant science course, where it's concurrent enrollment, receiving college credit while staying in the high school. And the other is CASE, which is a curriculum for agriculture science education. And CASE is in multiple areas, all the way from intro, all the way through natural resources, food science, animals, plants, everything like that. And so those are a couple hot topics. Food chemistry has become a very large need for our students. We can offer agriculture courses for science credit. However, with some of the recent legislative changes requiring a chemistry and physics requirement, that made us have to adjust again. And so we are now offering food chemistry for that chemistry credit. MLC also sponsored a pilot project to look at physics through our mechanics technology courses. So we are moving on some of that. We do ag literacy grants. We do natural resources grants, everything from college and elementary school through colleges. So we really are across the board. If you look at the program types, you can see where our money is specifically going. We have awarded $3.3 million in 450 grants throughout the time. You'll notice that number is different than that 2.7. That 2.7 is through those who've actually submitted final reports, so that have actually been put into our Qualtrics evaluation system. And so, but 3.3 has been going out, and you can see the percent types. Thank you. The percent types, about 50% of our grants are going to those local programs, going right back to your guys' districts, so 50% on there. And then we move into some of the more larger statewide projects, so MinSCU and the University of Minnesota and the Department of Education that are leading those projects. And this is just a fun map. Through the years, we've done a really good job of spreading out where our grants have gone. We've hit all the way up the Red River Valley to the bottom of the state to the Twin Cities. You'll notice that the Northeast is probably our weakest area. We just don't have a lot of agriculture programs, but I can tell you next week we are hosting a Northeast Ag Ed initiative and inviting about 15 schools to Grand Rapids High School and Grand Rapids and then Lake Superior school district, who just started an agriculture program, are coming to talk about how you implement a new program. So that was a fast brief, but you told me to be fast.
Very fast. I appreciate that.
So that is where our grants are, so I can answer any questions at this time.
Thank you. Members, do we have questions for Ms. Dornick? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Good presentation, and certainly MLC plays a key role in the education of our kids, high school, college education, teacher education. Could you give us some numbers as to how many students are in the university's ag education program, how many were placed in teaching, and what does it look like in terms of the market for how many we could place in ag education?
Yes. Chair Keel?
Yes, Ms.
Representative Anderson. So currently there's about 75 to 100 students in the agriculture education program at the University of Minnesota. To recognize that current program has two tracks. It has the ag teaching track, which is for licensure, and then they have the leadership and communications track, which is for students that are looking at communications or sales, ag industry. I have understood that it's about 50-50 that they are in. This spring, we have 15 student teachers that are out. They've actually started last week, and so they are doing their 11-week student teaching. We know that not all of those 15 actually end up teaching. I was one of those, for example. And so we know that our estimate was that we need at least 20 to enter the classroom. So we need to have 30 to 40 go into the Ag Ed teaching license major, and then we'll hopefully get 20 solidly at the end of the 4 years. We're looking at other options, such as the Masters of Education Initial Licensure Program. Milsey has started a scholarship program. That's for maybe someone who did an animal science degree. They get done, decide, you know what, maybe I want to be a teacher. We can get them licensed. They wouldn't complete the master's, but we could get them licensed in about a year. So we're finding that that is also a very efficient route to get teachers, qualified teachers out there faster. As far as demand for programs, pretty much every year we've had about 40 position openings every year. When you only have 225-ish positions, that's quite a big percentage. Some of those are teachers changing positions. Some of it, of course, teachers leaving the profession, changing schools, finding, you know, going to administration, et cetera, in the random teaching world. With STAR, we did do a statewide analysis this summer, and we did find we have more of a recruitment issue than a retention issue in our state. So we're looking a lot at the recruitment issues.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. And just a quick follow-up, Ms. Dornick. You mentioned possible programs in both Crookston and Marshall. What kind of numbers are you looking at those programs, just preliminarily?
Mm-hmm. Chair Keel.
Ms. Dornick.
Representative Anderson, good question. We aren't really sure. They are still working on their Board of Teaching. I do know that with the new person there, there are students that have already switched and are already currently going to SMSU. They have already switched and said they want to complete that. I just met a student that's doing a transfer, so she's at South Central College, and she's actually going to transfer to SMSU. I believe the number they presented at our MLC board meeting was they needed 20 students to be sustainable.
Representative Anderson? Okay. Representative Clark, or Johnson. I'm going to have trouble with that all.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's okay. And there's a nice story that goes with that. I'll tell you another day.
Good.
Thank you, Ms. Dornick. And I just wanted to pick up on your comment about the encouraging the master's licensure through the university. I want you to know that I work at Minnesota State with teacher preparation for social studies teachers. And we have a master's program that, or a graduate program, it's called Graduate Teacher Licensure. And that is our very effective tool to serve individuals who are out in industry or, you know, professionals in other fields to enter the field of teaching. And I think you may find that to be very productive. So I just want to give you a nudge on that one.
Thank you.
Members, before we move on, I think Representative Fabian has a question. Just wanted to remind you we have a real full schedule today. So with that, Representative Fabian, would you like to?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Dornick, I'm curious. You said that you have more of a problem with recruitment than retention, and you're working on that. So what strategies are you developing for recruitment?
Chair Keel, Representative Fabian.
Ms. Dornick.
I should preface that when I say we don't have a retention issue, I think that's because of the strong programs we've already implemented, such as our strong Ag Teachers Association, who has great professional development twice a year. We do a teacher induction program, a farm business management mentorship program. And so I think part of it is that retention is because of the family that we have built. So I don't want to diminish that. As far as recruitment, some strategies that we're working on, we, of course, are looking at scholarships. We're looking at some of the bills you may be seeing about, like, loan forgiveness, using that as a recruitment tool. We're working with the Minsky system, potentially this summer, having a, like, a camp. So we have a Change Lives Teach Agriculture event at the state convention, and it's just a one-day workshop, and that's been going really well. But we wanted to give them more an intensive really look into what being an ag teacher really means. And so we're looking at having a camp this summer for high school students to come and experience what it is for a week to be an ag teacher. And then we're also looking at having an internship program. So one thing that we have found is in college, they complete internships, and a lot of them go work for Pioneer, go work at all these lovely companies that are in agriculture, and they're already getting jobs. We had a student, she is student teaching this spring, but at the end of August, she had been offered a full-time job from Elanco already, and she had never even student taught. So we're trying to find ways to get them into the classroom, into that experience earlier and often. And so one idea we have that we're working on finding funding for is an internship program. So they would actually complete an ag ed internship in the summer, and they would be paid just like any other intern, and hopefully get that experience and say, this is what I want to do.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Dornak. I know it's a really exciting area, and we'd like to see lots of people come into agriculture. So thank you. Next, we have Mr. Moliner, Jim Moliner from Minsku, if he would step forward. And while he's coming up, I would just like to tell the members that Chair Hamilton has been asked to speak at a rare disease disorder day. So that's where he is. So if you see him around and wonder what's going on, he's explaining some of that, discussing that. So thank you. Mr. Moliner, if you would identify yourself and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. And you mentioned Minsku. I am a farm business management instructor at St. Cloud Technical and Community College. I provide education to farmers in about a 50-mile radius around St. Cloud, and when my program is full, I'll probably have about 50 farm families that I will serve, and my position is very much like other farm business management instructors around the state. Kind of asked at a late moment if I would come and speak to the Rural Mental Health Program. In my previous position as regional director, I actually had the opportunity to initiate the Rural Mental Health Program. It came about via a grant from the Otto Bremer Foundation, and it came out of a need. What we realized was that farmers are under a lot of stress. Sometimes there are events that happen that cause stress. Sometimes it's just normal life. But at that time, it was flooding in western Minnesota, and a rural mental health counselor approached us. He had funding from FEMA, and he said, why are plumbers coming to me, hardware store owners, truck drivers, all the people that are affected by the flood, and yet I have no farmers have come in my door? I can't believe that farmers haven't been affected by the flood. And that was 1997. And we hit up a partnership realizing that farmers really didn't like going to a psychologist office on Main Street, Minnesota, in Graysville, Minnesota, because by 4 p.m. everyone in the community would know that Farmer Joe had been in to see the shrink. Excuse my language. We hit up a partnership where Ted Matthews was made integral part of the farm management program. So just as we met with farmers with their financial dealings, Ted Matthews was available to speak to any of the needs that the farm might have, which are very varied. So Otto Bremer got us started. Actually, in 2002, the Agriculture Committee of the Legislature provided some funding to get us going. We had a gap where it wasn't funded, and then about 2004, I think, funded again and has been since then. I believe the funding level is at $93,000. That pays for the counselor's salary, but he has to pay his own insurance, travel expenses. He is serving as a contractor. I guess I'd just say, you know, I was the initiator. I am no longer the supervisor of that program, but I probably have, you know, the knowledge, so here I am. And I would just say that it's hard to measure a program like this, because how do you measure something that doesn't happen? If a farm family doesn't leave your community because of internal strife, if they're still there, how do you measure that was an accomplishment? Or if someone doesn't commit suicide because they were counseled, there's really no measure. But I guess I would just have to say my observation now over these years since 1997, this program has really made a difference. It works hand in hand with the farm management program, but I know staff from the Department of Agriculture have called in various situations asking for help. The Dairy Profit Team program has called the counselor and asked him for help in various situations. So with that, I think if there is any time left, I'll just leave it for questions. And thank you so much for the opportunity this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Molinar. Representative Poppy, would you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually don't have a question for Mr. Molinar, but I just wanted to attest to the good work that Ted Matthews does for rural mental health. I represent Riverland Community College, is in my district, and we have a farm business management program. And I know that Mr. Matthews travels all over the state to work with farm families, and he does a tremendous job. I know that we had a situation where even one of our farm business management instructors' children was involved in a fatal car crash. They actually, it was a tremendously serious issue for, and Ted was there within hours, and he's hours and hours away. So I know that he is just so tremendous at what he does. He works with everyone with regards to, you know, if it is just a highly stressful situation. And just regarding the amount, I actually have a bill that we're trying to increase the amount of money that is available for this work, because right now we're going through even, you know, greater stress again with farm families. And, you know, and just as they're looking at talking to their children and grandchildren about carrying on with being farmers or going into ag business, you know, Mr. Matthews does a great deal of good work. So I just wanted to attest to that. And thank you for the testimony today.
And thank you.
Thank you. Any other members with questions? Okay. Well, I thank you very much, Mr. Molinar, for stopping by. Next, we have Jerry Schoenfeld and Joe Schapansky. Good morning, and would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent?
Morning, Madam Chair. My name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I represent the Minnesota Federation of County Fairs. And just to give you a little background on this, there is actually a chapter of law in our state statutes that deals with county fairs, and part of that chapter deals with distribution of some of the funds. There are two areas that, and it's called Chapter 38 for those that want to take a look at that. There are two different areas that grants do come through the Department of Agriculture for county fairs. The first is a long-standing grant program, and I had talked to one of to your research staff earlier to try to remember. I believe it's like $974,000 for the biennium. Am I accurate on that, Mr. Sullivan?
Mr. Sullivan.
Madam Chair and members, the appropriation is $474,000 per year, or roughly the amount that you stated for the biennium.
Right. Madam Chair, those funds actually end up in the hands of 4-H'ers and FFA members. They're part of the premium funding program that helps to take care of the 4-H and FFA exhibits that go forward, so it's part of that program to provide funds for 4-H and FFA members and some open class as well. In addition to that, there's one other fund that was started about 4 years ago, and I need to give a little history of this so you may follow it. Presently, in the session law from the past 2 years, it states that these funds have to be used for arts, history, or cultural events at the fairs. And I'll give you a little history as to where that came from. 4 years ago, when the Legacy Fund first was on the horizon, there was an effort to provide funds through the Legacy Fund, and at that time it was provided at $2.8 million. What happened was that after 2 years of receiving funds through the Legacy Fund, the state arts people took great objection to the fact that county fairs were receiving money out of the Arts Legacy Fund. And so because of that and their opposition, Senator Cohen in particular in the Senate looked for a different alternative place to provide these funds. And so what happened was that in the 2 years ago, rather than taking it through the Arts Legacy Fund, these funds were taken in the committee, Senator Tomasoni's committee, and what is now Representative Hamilton's committee here, dealing with dealing with the Agri Fund, and so the funds came out of there. It originally $2 million. Last year, $200,000 was added to that, so presently there are $2.2 million for the biennium that is are going for this purpose. The program is run through the Department of Agriculture. It is it's a pass-through grant, but the department does have oversight to ensure that it's used for those purposes. Now, this year, I believe the department is asking for a change order to eliminate that restriction that it must be used for arts, culture, or heritage, instead that could be used for a broader range of things with county fairs. Initially, that was a competitive grant program. That changed 2 years ago so that it became a program that was equally distributed to all the fairs in the state. So I believe the number is somewhere around $13,000 that each fair gets from that distribution. And so, Madam Chair and members, that's kind of the background of what these pass-through grants are about. I have with me Joe Skopansky, who is on a fair board, and I thought you might just enjoy talking to a real live fair board member rather than a lobbyist. So I brought him along with to discuss how he sees using these funds in a local level.
Thank you. Would you please introduce yourself for the record?
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Joe Skopansky, representatives. Jerry asked me a couple days ago to come in and tell us, like you said, a live person from the fair industry to come and tell you kind of what we did. So I did write a few things out, and I guess if we have any questions, we'll go to that. I'm from rural Sauk Rapids. I grew up on a dairy farm. I still have a beef and cattle cow operation. I'm a township supervisor for over 20 years, fair board director for 20 years. I'm a 4-H and FFA alumni. I've been on the Federation of County Fairs directors for 5 years, and now I'm currently on the Board of Managers for the State Fair. I guess I'm asking on behalf of all Minnesota Ag Societies for your support. I have visited over 50% of the 90-plus fairs in 87 counties, and in those I've witnessed the growing number of fair guests who want to learn by seeing and touching the livestock exhibits, to listen to music, poets, to watch dance and acting, and demonstrations on quilting, cooking, and eating healthy, where organic has become part of our culture. To come to understand that food and fiber sustains our very existence. The county fair is the most versatile venue where all can be experienced in one place in our own community. The fair is a place to visit whether you're 90 years old or 9 days old, and we've seen that. And it doesn't matter what our financial status is, and now we are experiencing an audience of wide cultural diversity, especially where I live in the St. Cloud area. The education on livestock sciences and arts are always on our forefront. Most fairs have free admittance or a small charge to enter. Last Thursday, I was invited by our arts board to go down to the Capitol here, and I met a lady that was a programmer at St. Cloud State University for 30 years. She said she came to our fair in Benton County and said that she, because we had a powwow going on in our children's activity area, and she mentioned she saw a mother giving her three children animal crackers, and her perception was that they couldn't afford anything else. It is our goal that the fair should be enjoyable and admittance-free, kept to a minimum so all can enjoy. We have a long tradition that some ag societies were chartered when Minnesota was still a state, was a territory, and before statehood, a place where a community can come together in observing what progressing in food, fiber, arts, and science. The need to maintain and upgrade our facilities is always a challenge. Many fairs are hand-to-mouth with their fixed incomes, insurance, fire protection, maintenance, plus many don't meet new or the newer electrical codes. And paying for security is increasing. Lighting and sound are exhibits and demonstrations needs upgrading. And handicap accessibility on sidewalks, bathrooms need maintenance for our guest safety. Get mixed up here. We strive to use the budgets where we bring to the best venues we can afford. We stress education and competition as a tool to stretch the minds of our youth. With the dollars that we were given, all fairs the past few years, especially more distant rural areas with smaller populations, came a burst of new life in programming. We have observed the attendance on the conservative side has increased 10 to 15% over the last 3 years. This past year's attendance was estimated at 615,000 throughout the state. The fairgoers, when surveyed, which was part of the criteria for getting the allotment, said that the fairs have a new flavor, that it's just not the animals on one end and the midway on the other. Some said unexplainable, yet new life, new things to see and to do. And I can attest that because we had the extra funds to bring in new and alternative programming has given our local fairs a place where the public has said we have to go to see what they have new this year. And yes, 4-H and FFA are still viable in our community, and they also have increased and enhanced their programming. All of this costs money, and as fair directors, we try to do our best to put out the best venue for education, entertainment for the betterment of the community, the enrichment of showing and telling the public of how important agriculture is to all of us. We have a few days once a year to showcase the fair. The funds we receive help us make it an enjoyable experience so that our guests can come back again next year to see what's new in agriculture and most of all to experience community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schapansky. Is it Schapansky?
Close enough.
Okay. Those skis are hard to pronounce, but anyway, members, do you have any questions for Representative Johnson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Schapansky. I just want to thank you for your comment about your observation about the, well, I presume low-income family enjoying the fair. A couple of years ago when I was at the Nicola County Fair, I ate lunch with a woman and her child, and she made clear to me that that was a really nice opportunity for her and her child and to attend the free fair, and I think that that's an important part of what we're doing with the fairs. And I also want to pick up on the milk producers who produce pretty cheap malt or milkshake at the fair too. And so it is, it's a reason, my point is that it's very valuable. We have a mixed income group in my district, and to serve the entire community, the fair plays a really important role. And I know when you're struggling as a young family, you look forward to that fair because it's something you can take your family to. So thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Representative Chair Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick question for Mr. Schoenfeld. How many counties have county fairs across Minnesota?
Mr. Chairman, there are 87 counties. I believe 86, I think, have got the fairs. But there are over 90 fairs. If you go up into northeastern Minnesota, because of the size of St. Louis County, I believe there are three fairs in that area. So, and there are one or two other counties, I think, that also have an east and west kind of a fair. So there are actually more fairs than there are counties. I want to just briefly mention one other thing, too. These fairs vary a great deal. If anybody's been down to Steele County to see the Steele County Fair, that's the former site at one time back in the 1800s of the state fair. And that fair is the largest fair in the state and really is quite a thing to see. It probably competes against state fairs in neighboring states. In other cases, they're as small as at Floodwood, for instance. It's literally one building on Main Street that is part of that for exhibits and so forth. So it's quite a variance in terms of that. But I can tell you, too, that probably the typical fair, and I'm sure Mr. Schapansky could add to this, but a typical fair might spend $60,000 to $80,000 on their fair for the year. So when they get $13,000 from the state to help cover some of those expenses, it's quite significant. Normally in this place, $13,000 doesn't even make a rounding error for an individual group. But for these fairs, it's a pretty significant situation.
Thank you. Members, any other questions? Well, I thank you, testifiers, for your contribution, and we'll look forward to working with this budget. So the next testifier is Second Harvest. Is it Linda Fadimia? Thank you. Would you please identify yourself and who you represent for the record?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Laurel Fatima with Second Harvest Heartland. I'm the Chief Community Engagement Officer there. And with me today is Rob Zesky, our CEO at Second Harvest Heartland. And we're both going to be talking to you today Handouts are coming around right now on our two agenda items.
Thank you. Good morning. Again, my name is Rob Zeski. It's a pleasure to be here today. Just wanted to kick off. We are representing this morning six food banks that serve collectively all of the counties in Minnesota. The food banks, certainly Second Harvest Heartland, serving the metro area in central southwest Minnesota. Channel One, based in Rochester. The food bank in Duluth, in Grand Rapids, in Crookston, and the Fargo Food Bank, which serves essentially more at the one county there. We are here, as Laurel said, to discuss two items. One, a milk appropriation, and secondly, the farm to food shelf, the farm to food shelf program. We're here in part with some urgency in that as we've continued to see strong economic indicators throughout our economy, from the jobless rate to stock market returns, we continue to see record need among the people that we serve at the food shelf level. Our 2014 numbers compared to 2013 continue to push into record territory with double-digit increases year over year. And indeed, since 2007, at the very front end of the recession, we have seen visits to Minnesota food shelves more than double, with 600,000 people turning to Minnesota food shelves for assistance with their food needs in 2014 alone. We also know that despite these increases in many of our economic indicators that are favorable, we know that the people who turn to the food shelves for support are often disproportionately hit with other health challenges and also chronic diseases. According to a Feeding America study that we conducted last year in our service area in Minnesota, while the state average diabetes rate among adults is 7%, the people that we serve, the household level, was 35% of households served by food shelves had diabetes, 44% had hypertension. So very strong, disproportionate needs for us. And so today, as we think about the challenges of serving our neighbors, we are looking to two programs in milk and farm to food shelf, which supports the capture of vegetables and produce that might otherwise go to waste. We are looking at some fantastic programs to help not only fill bellies, but also support the health of those neighbors that are disproportionately likely to be sick and ill with some of those conditions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Laura.
We would like to talk about the milk grant first. Just a quick summary, the milk grant is currently in the Department of Ag base budget at $500,000 a year or $1 million per biennium, and it's been so for a number of years. And we are asking this year for an increase in the exact same program, no changes to how the program runs, but an increase for the money applied to it. And the reason is that the current dollar amounts at $500,000 a year for the six food banks in across the state of Minnesota allows us to buy milk for food shelf clients for 4.5 months out of the year. And then the money runs out. That's how great the need is. For the rest of the year, Second Harvest provides fundraised dollars that we buy on behalf of the food banks, or by the end of the year, many times there is no more. So we're looking at an increase because milk is nutritious. It's a really highly requested item at food shelves. Children and seniors, our most vulnerable populations that visit food shelves, are very much in need of milk. More than 33% of those served by the food shelves are kids, and about 10% are seniors. And we all know for nutritious reasons that milk is really important to both those groups. We also know that we run on donated food as food banks, and fluid milk is, we have some very generous donors, but fluid milk is very rarely donated, and hence we come to you today. And needless to say, low-income families often find it prohibitively expensive to buy on their own. So at $1 million, $1.5 million a year, or $3 million in a biennium, that would cover for us through the food banks partners across the state for approximately 12 months for each of the 2 years of the biennium. How does the program work? Just very quickly, because of Second Harvest size, we are the largest food bank in the state in our central location. Our food bank peers have authorized us to act as their agent in disbursing these funds. So the grant money is to purchase milk is allocated to each food bank based on an allocation we all agree on that tracks to the number of people in poverty in each food bank's territory. And that's been done for the entire duration of the program. Milk must be purchased from Minnesota milk processors. It's based on low-cost bids. The milk is purchased by the food banks and distributed to the six, by those food banks out to food shelves. That's what we do. We procure and distribute food, and we do that with milk once it's purchased through this program. Then it is made directly available to clients. Second Harvest then in its role submits quarterly reports for the commissioner and handles the invoicing and reimbursement. Talk a little bit about impact. The most recent full year grant, we distributed almost 200,000 gallons of milk through this program, or about 3.2 million servings. That's a lot of milk. And we do that with some really efficient purchasing power, those low-cost bids. And we know the grant money is there for working extremely hard. So there's some detail in your document about kind of how many servings and gallons each of the food banks in your areas has served and distributed. And want to see if there's any questions at this time.
Members, do you have any questions of our testifiers? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Very good program. When you deal with the milk, are you talking the whole milk, 1%, 2% skim milk? What kinds are you working with?
It's skim milk.
Ms. Fadima. Okay.
Madam Chair, committee members, it's skim milk.
Skim milk. Okay. Any other questions, members? Oh, thank you very much. Did you want to...
Madam Chair, we do have the second program we'd like to quickly go over, with your permission. We'd like to
go
talk
ahead.
About Farm to Food Shelf, and you also have a handout that's been passed out about that. As Rob mentioned and talked a little bit about the health situations facing many, many food shelf clients in the state that are really notable and higher than the general population, we have just, we're in the middle of completing our first program year with the Farm to Food Shelf Grant Program. It is a $2 million appropriation appropriated to the Minnesota Department of Agriculture over a three-year period. This is the first of the 3 years. And its purpose is to help agricultural producers and processors offset the cost to harvest and pack their donated fruits and vegetables. So we're really trying to provide a mechanism and an urgency to farmers, give them a little help. All the food they donate to us, but it takes money to get that food out of the ground and cooled and packed, ready for transfer, and that's what the dollars in this appropriation go for. We don't necessarily defer all costs, but it's offsetting some costs to really incent them to consider donating the food itself to us, and we've had some really great success in our first year. It's administered, again, through the six Feeding America food banks serving the state, just like milk, and we are requesting this year a $1.1 million per year appropriation that would go in the state's base. So recurring funding is what we're asking for, again, through the Minnesota Department of Agriculture to support this program, with some expanded authority to also look at purchasing or incenting the consideration of donating protein. Why is this program important? Significantly raises the amount of fresh produce moving through the system. We know that just in the first 7 months of the program, we've moved about 5.3 million pounds of fresh produce through the six food banks and subsequently then out to the food shelves. That's and by the time we get to year end, it'll be about 5.8 million. That'll be about a 30% increase over what was done the year before in a pilot program we tested before we came to the legislature for this program. So we're moving a lot of produce and a lot of pounds. And there's 23 different types, ranging from squash and corn and potatoes and zucchini and greens and all sorts of different produce. The variety is wonderful. So we're increasing the amount of fresh produce, better nutrition, better food security. There's more food there. We know that improves worker productivity, student learning, and supports that health. A big issue also is that there's a lot of food, for whatever reason, that goes to waste. And this is really getting at reducing that waste and putting that food to good use while achieving some local economic benefit for farmers and processors in offsetting their marginal costs. We like it because the program brings together the private, nonprofit, and government sectors. And in that sense, we think it's a really great project. Just very quickly how the program works. Minnesota egg producers or processors, if they have Minnesota-grown crops, they may donate to this program. Edible and commonly used produce is what we're looking for. The food must meet safety standards and be fit to eat. that, as we said, the reimbursement is for their cost to harvest and pick and pack out, we call it, and get things ready for transfer to then donate that produce. The reimbursement rates, which vary by type of produce, are designed to, again, help offset those costs. We have done some tremendous marketing and had some help with some of our farm organization partners, some of whom are in the room today. Program marketing occurred directly to farmers via email, mail. Our staff is visiting farms on site, farmers markets, and through our farm organization partners like AgriGirl, Farm Bureau, and Farmers Union. Interested farmers then contact us and or a food shelf for qualified donations and arrange the logistics, pick up an agreement, and move from there. And then it gets into the system, and we handle, again, a second harvest on behalf of all the food banks, the receiving and the reporting, the administration and the reimbursement. We're happy to report that this program has distributed produce to all 87 counties across the state and touched more than 700 agencies and programs in doing that. Interesting enough, in the month of September, which, as you can imagine, that's when harvest occurs in Minnesota, has been our busiest month for this program. We believe we served about 90,000 Minnesota families. So we're anxious to continue it, anxious to have it in the base, and believe that, and based on what we're hearing from our food shelves and certainly some clients, we know they love the produce. Madam Chair, we'd like to open it up for questions.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions for our testifiers? Well, then, thank you very much, and appreciate and nice to hear your success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Bruce Clavin, and is it Mr. Mark Weber? And if you would please state your name for the record and identify your representation. Oh, that's, and Mr. Zutz.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Bruce Clayton, I am registered and represent the Minnesota Turf Seed Council here. You'll see I'm listed as the witness, but our Secretary Marv Zutz was able to come down today, so he'll provide you with the testimony on the pass-through. Also here on my left is Mark Weber, as you mentioned, from the Northern Crops Institute. They're not related, but they are in a sense. I met both of these gentlemen on the same day the ground in Fargo, North Dakota by West Acres and on a Monday afternoon in August of 94, and they were the first two guys along with Dave Torgerson that I represented here at the legislature. So I've known them for many years and thought that since they came to town they could sit here together with me. So Mark will do the testimony on the turf seed side and Mark here will do the Northern Crops report for them.
Thank you. Mr. Zutz, would you like to identify yourself?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Marvin Zutz. I'm from Red Lake Falls, Minnesota. And I'll give you a brief history of the turf seed industry in northern Minnesota. The grass seed industry in northern Minnesota had a long history, starting with an annual appropriation of $35,000 from the Iron Range Resources and Rehabilitation Commission that started in 1948. It was to develop the grass and the legume seed industry in northern Minnesota. These monies helped the University of Minnesota to develop the park variety of Kentucky bluegrass. The park bluegrass was first planted experimentally on 3 acres of on a field near Roseau in 1953. The results from that production of that first field were excellent and spawned the grass seed industry in Roseau and Lake of the Woods counties. These counties have produced 25,000 acres of park grass annually until the year 2000. Minnesota currently ranks third in the production of turf and forage seed behind Oregon and Washington State. Minnesota has several competitive advantages over the seed production regions of Washington and Oregon. The cost of production in Minnesota is lower, and the seed is consistently of high quality and free of the annual bluegrass seed, a noxious weed in the turf and sod industry. Oregon is currently tearing up the top yielding ryegrass fields and replacing them with hazelnuts, something for the committee to remember. Perennial ryegrass is a relative newcomer to the species produced in Minnesota. Over the last 10 years, the University of Minnesota has released 5 new perennial ryegrass varieties, specifically designed for seed production in Minnesota. In 2001, the number of acres was less than 1,000 in the state of Minnesota. In 2005, production was estimated at 12,000 acres, and the processors told me last week that they are projecting 40,000 acres of ryegrass production in 2015. I found this press release from the year 2005 in my files, and I thought it would be of interest to the committee. It says, Pennis Stump Secure Turf Grass Research Grant. Representative Maxine Pennis and State Senator Leroy Stump, chief offers of the Northern Minnesota Turf Grass Bill, were successful in passing legislation through the Minnesota legislature appropriating $65,000 annually for turf grass research in Roseland, Lakewood, Woods counties. The new research dollars will be used to augment and expand research currently being funded by the University of Minnesota on the Magnuson Research Farm, located just north of Roseau. The Minnesota Turf Seed Council, a council comprised of area farmers, processors, and university researchers, will oversee the distribution of the research funds. The funds will be used to enhance the development of new higher yielding turf grass seed. Goes on to say that the Minnesota legislature recognized the need and came up with the funding for the project, and it was a very tough legislation session. Persistence pays off. In 2001, Maxine had brought a bill to get research money for turf grass research. Now, 4 years later, we were able to secure the funding. These research dollars will assist the turf grass industry to continue to be an economic engine for northern Minnesota. As a sub-note, Dennis Osmond was chairman of the Ag Committee back in those days. Okay. The Magnuson Research Farm is the northernmost experiment station in Minnesota. The Magnuson family gifted the University of Minnesota 40 acres of prime land to enhance the research of crops in that region. In addition to the ryegrass research, we assist the university with the research of biomass. Currently, we have biomass research plots in Waseca, Lamberton, Staples, Grand Rapids, Manoman, Crookston, Red Lake Falls, and Roseau. A short compilation of the research conducted at the Magnuson Research Farm. We have over 3,000 small plot research trials. Included in those trials, we have 1,400 variety trials as comprised of bluegrass, perennial ryegrass, vine fescue, tall fescue, canola, barley, oats, spring wheat, soybeans, and winter wheat. We have four crossing blocks up there of ryegrass and switchgrass. We have 456 biomass trials up on the Roseau station. We have 568 fertility trials ongoing at the farm. We have 56 fungicide trials. We have 124 herbicide trials and 332 other trials. So the total of the small plots up at that Magnuson Research Farm totaled 2,940 plots. We also have larger farm grower research trials conducted up in that area for a total of 73 large demonstration plots. The overall total is over 3,000 plots. We have two winter meetings and one summer field day where the research information is presented to the producers. We also maintain a website which contains all the research information and send out a production email to each grower weekly to keep them informed on timely field production practices. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I couldn't help but chime in here a little bit. I want to put in a good word. The Magnuson Research Farm is amazing, and what's gone on there over the years. When I first moved to Roseau back a few years ago, in the middle 70s, it was thriving then, and the evolution of the grass market and the grass that's growing has really been interesting to watch. And you know, when you talk about the Magnuson Farms, the first tractor that I drove in Roseau County belonged to Yvonne Magnuson, who donated the land to the research farm and stuff. So it's and Richard has carried on that tradition, and it's really doing great work. And now we've got the partnership with Northland Community Technical College with the unmanned aerial systems and the infrared imaging and stuff that they're doing. It's really a gem, that's for sure. Thank you.
Chair Anderson?
Thanks, Madam Chair. This sounds interesting, and I'm just curious as to around the Roseau area, is it the climate or the soils or what that's been so conducive to your turf seed industry?
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson? Yes, it's a lot to do with the climate, but also we're expanding out of the Lake of the Woods, Roseau County areas. We're introducing, the fescues. And to avoid contamination with the ryegrasses, we're expanding to the surrounding counties to keep those isolated. But it's a cool season grass and grown primarily up in the northern regions.
Excuse me. Chair Anderson? Follow-up? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one follow-up. Mr. Zutz, you said that at one time the IRRRB was helping out financially. I'm wondering if they're still doing that.
Okay. I'm glad we shrunk the district.
I'm just poking a little fun at my friends from the Iron Range here. Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Right. Thank you, Mr. Zutz. Mr. Weber, would you like to identify yourself and tell us who you represent?
Madam Chairwoman, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here this morning. For the record, my name is Mark Weber, and I serve as the director of the Northern Crops Institute, located up on the NDSU campus in Fargo, North Dakota. The NCI was developed in 1983 with an initial appropriation from the North Dakota legislature for the purpose of promoting the crops in the northern region of the United States of North and South Dakota, Minnesota, and Montana. And since that initial appropriation, the state of Minnesota and the state of South Dakota also began to provide some funding for that effort. We have a staff of 11 people, a number of them food and feed scientists. We've got a flour mill, a feed mill, and an auditorium equipped to handle a number of languages at once. We've got a board of directors made up of the commodity groups from the four-state region, and our current chairperson is a Minnesota soybean farmer from north of Detroit Lakes, Carolyn Zern, serves as the chairperson of the Northern Crops Institute. We also have a representative from the Minnesota Corn Council, as well as North Harvest Bean Growers, sitting on the board of directors. So basically, how we promote the crops in the region is we bring teams from worldwide to our facility on the campus. They'll spend 3 to 5 days there training, where we teach them how to utilize the crops that we grow in this region in their food and feed products. We do that through a series of lectures and work in our laboratories. To date, we've had visitors from 145 countries that have come to visit us. The role of the NCI has expanded significantly in the last number of years. The four-state region, we lead the nation in a total of 15 different crops that we raise when we combine the four states. As you well know, we've had significant increases in soybeans and corn in this region, and so we've expanded the programs accordingly. We're not a research facility, and we don't teach people how to grow crops, but rather our customers worldwide how to utilize the crops. We've got several important partners besides the various state legislatures. We work very closely with the commodity groups. The commodity groups of the four states provide probably 50% of the funding. So the Minnesota Soybean Council, Minnesota Corn Council, Minnesota Wheat Council, North Harvest Bean Growers, Minnesota Barley Growers are all commodity groups that provide funding for the programs that we have up there. We also work very closely with the land-grant universities. Besides North Dakota State, we work closely with the U of M, South Dakota State, and Montana State as well. In terms of the short courses, we offer about 12 to 15 short courses per year. The courses are quite a variety: pasta production, grain procurement, durum wheat milling, rheology of wheat and flour quality, baking with soy, barley malt, food safety. This is the soybean procurement, feed manufacturing, on how to utilize more soybeans and corn in the feed rations. So we have quite a variety of the projects that we offer for our customers. One of the things we've worked closely with at the U of M, the U of M has done a lot of research to demonstrate that the soybeans grown in the state of Minnesota, North and South Dakota, have a much higher feeding value than previously thought. Through the marketplace over the years, the soybeans in this tri-state region have been discounted significantly because it was thought because of the protein levels that didn't have the feeding values. The good research done by the scientists at U of M discovered that we have higher feeding value than we might originally have thought. That's one of the concepts that we will be teaching and have been teaching at the Northern Crops Institute for our customers that are coming particularly from Southeast Asia that use a lot of corn and soybeans in their feed rations. So we will be teaching that concept that the soybeans, when we look at the value from this region, have a much higher feeding value. In terms of wheat, a couple of success stories that we can document. We held a course a couple of years ago. A new flour mill manager from Indonesia attended a course on procuring wheat. And when he brought samples of wheat that he had been buying from Australia and other sources, we compared those. We did some side-by-side baking trials, some analytical tests with those wheat flours, compared that to the wheat flour that we grow in northern Minnesota, and with those side-by-side tests, we were able to demonstrate that the high protein quality wheat was really the superb product. He went home and made a very first purchase of U.S. hard red spring wheat to the tune of $9 million. So that was a good start there, a good example of what we did in wheat. In terms of soybeans, like I said, we worked very closely with the Minnesota Soybean Council on this. We had a course a couple years ago where a procurement manager from a trading company in Vietnam attended a course learning how to buy the soybeans off of our market. Previously, they had been buying soybeans only by the container full. And a container is, you know, basically a container that would go on the back end of a semi. That's all that they had been buying. Through the results of that course, they began importing a bulk soy meal by ship. And they've landed 3 to 4 boatloads thus far, and their goal is to import one vessel of soy meal from this region out of AGP's facility located on the PNW. So that, in a nutshell, is the types of programs that we're doing at the NCI. For those of you that haven't had a chance to come by and visit, we'd welcome you anytime you're up in the Fargo-Moorhead area to come by. I know Representative Keel has been to our facility, and I invite you all to do the same. So that's it in a quick nutshell of the programs that we do at the Northern Crops Institute. And I want to thank this committee and the legislature of Minnesota for providing the funding that you have done so in the past. So we appreciate that very much and appreciate the opportunity to be here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Weber. Do we have any questions for Mr. Weber? I know Chair Anderson and I enjoyed touring that facility, so if you get an opportunity, it's quite interesting to see what's happening there and how our crops are encouraged to be marketed overseas. So, all right, with that, thank you very much. Oh, yes, Mr. Clevin.
Here, on Northern Crops, as I mentioned, I don't work for them directly, but I do work for the wheat growers and the barley growers. As Mr. Weber mentioned, they're strong supporters of the work done there. In terms of the funding in your bill that you'll see probably later this session in March or April, I look back and this Minnesota's contribution to the NCI was $70,000 per year back in 97. It was the same level in 2001. By 2005, it had slipped to $50,000, and the last biennium was down to $47,000. So I point out a little bit of the decline in Minnesota's contribution, but I also want to point out that North Dakota, the state of North Dakota, puts $1 million in per year, and South Dakota is at $75,000. And so we're running third by quite a margin, and we're letting South Dakota beat you in the funding. So maybe as we get towards the session, we can revisit those numbers. Maybe find one of Jerry's rounding errors somewhere around here and bump up the NCI a little bit. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clement. Okay. With that, we will welcome Mr. Polk from Minnesota Livestock Breeders Association. Okay. Well, welcome, Mr. Polk. Would you identify yourself for the record and who you represent?
For the record, my name is Steve Polk. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of the Minnesota Livestock Breeders. And I'll give you just a brief history of the organization. I heard a few of the organizations that have been up here started in the 80s and the 90s. The Livestock Breeders started in 1896, 119 years ago. And currently it consists of 20 different breeds or organizations of purebred livestock, including dairy cattle, beef cattle, purebred swine, sheep, dairy goats, and draft horses. And there's within those 20 breeds of livestock, there are about 2,800 members, and 25 of them serve as board members on the organization. And they meet three times annually. Much of the grant money, and we've been receiving $18,000 a year the last number of years, I don't know, 5-6 years anyway. Much of it goes towards youth programming. FFA, 4-H programs are supported heavily by the livestock breeders. We give grant money to these FFA and 4-H groups. Judging teams go into national contests. We also manage the junior livestock show at the state fair, which is called the 4-H auction. And within that framework of the 4-H auction, there's a number of scholarships given out to 4-H and FFA kids to further their education in agriculture. About 20 to 30 scholarships are given out. And we raise matching funds so those scholarships double in value each year. So a lot of that goes towards 4-H and FFA, plaques, scholarships, and we also sponsor a number of other youth-related shows in the state. MinRoyal is one that they sponsor. Minnesota Ag in the Classroom is also involved and sponsored by livestock breeders. Minnesota Beef Expo, just to name a few. Another large function of the organization is to have a judges conference annually. We try to train judges to judge livestock and how to treat kids in the show ring. So that's handled by the livestock breeders and done pretty much on an annual basis. And one of the other major functions of the organization is to assist the Board of Animal Health with animal health related situations and advise them. One of our board members sits on the current Board of Animal Health. So I don't know if are there any questions of me. I briefly described the organization.
Members, do you have any questions for Mr. Pope? Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned your support of young folks at county fairs and such and some of the breeds that you worked with. At my local county fair, it seems like the number of entries in your traditional breeds of, you know, hogs and cattle and such are stable, but goats are really increasing in number at the fairs. Are you seeing that statewide, too? Is that a thing that the young folks are really getting into in terms of showing at the fairs?
Mr. Polk.
Madam Chair, Representative Anderson, I believe you're talking, I'm going to guess you're talking about meat goats. And we're seeing at fairs a lot more meat goats coming in. Seems to be the current popular livestock project, and we see some of those things happening over time. I would guess it's going to stabilize, but yes, goats are becoming very popular.
Representative Anderson, any other members have questions? I think it's wonderful that you're encouraging students to, you know, raise animals, and that support is wonderful. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee.
Next, we're going to hear from the Minnesota Horticulture Society, Rose Eggert. Welcome, and would you please identify yourself for the record?
My name is Rose Eggert. I'm the CEO for the Minnesota State Horticultural Society. And with me today is Bob Newman. Bob is our chair of our board of directors.
Thank you. Go ahead.
I'd like to thank the committee for this opportunity to report on the use of our appropriation of $17,000 per year. For 149 years, the Minnesota State Horticultural Society has provided cold climate gardening resources throughout the state of Minnesota. Our mission is to serve northern gardeners through education, encouragement, and community. We currently have a staff of 5 full-time employees, 2 part-time, and 1 part-time employee that is funded through a grant program. Our board is made up of 17 statewide members, including Rochester and Red Wing. We have representatives on our board from Bailey's Nursery, Wagner's Nursery, Garden World, Como Conservatory, DNR Forestry, and the City of St. Paul Park and Rec. We have a volunteer program that contributes over 3,300 hours on a yearly basis to our outreach programs, and that service is valued at over $70,000. Our appropriation through this committee is to fund our publication, Northern Gardener Magazine. It's our number one resource and benefit of our membership. It's the longest continually published magazine in the state of Minnesota. Our membership is currently at 14,000 members and subscribers, with a total readership of the magazine of 35,000 per issue. I've included in your packet a copy of the magazine for you to review. Northern Gardener is also used through garden clubs, plant societies, and other garden-related organizations to list their programs, events, and tours. And you'll see that on page 4, 5, and 6 of the current issue that you have. Other benefits of our membership are discounts at over 100 commercial partners, and those are wrapped on your magazine, and they all offer a variety of discounts to our members. Bachman's, Mickman Brothers, and Otten Brothers are to mention a few. And the full list of our benefits to the organization are featured in the magazine. Membership dues are currently 50% of our revenue budget. Other areas of revenue for the society are through educational classes, advertising in the magazine, merchandise sales, and fundraising. And I've included that breakout of that information in your packet also. Other outreach programs that we have are called, we have one called Minnesota Green and a new program called Garden in a Box. Minnesota Green is in its 27th year, and we work with the garden centers in around the state. And when they have plant material that they no longer can sell on the retail floor, they donate it to the society, and we in turn pass that on to over 60 community garden sites throughout the state. And last year, plant material valued at over $70,000 was donated to the society. And we featured one of the recipients of the program in your magazine on page 12. A new program for the society is called Garden in a Box. And it's only in its 4th year, and it's a program in where we donate to low-income families and children through school programs a 3x4 garden box, soil, plants, seeds, and education, so that we can educate them on where their food is coming from and how to eat in a more healthy way. And it's been a great success. We've just started a partnership with Habitat for Humanity, and they had a one box. They tested it last year, and this year they're coming back and they're requesting 10 boxes. So I just see that program growing and growing. The program is completely funded by grants, and this year we've received a grant from Cargill. General Mills has supported the program for the last 2 years, and St. Paul Garden Club and individual donors through the society put their money, their gift to the program. In the 4 years, we've distributed over 700 boxes, and it is throughout the state. So we have 61% in East Metro, 18% in the West Metro, 13% that go to Duluth, 5% to St. Cloud, and 3% to Faribault. One thing that we also do with this program is that the second year participants, we provide plant material to them. We don't provide the soil and everything, but we do give them the plants. So we want them to continue to garden. And we're finding that 50% of the recipients are continuing to garden with the boxes. So again, I want to thank you for this opportunity to be in front of you. And Bob Newman will say a few words now.
Mr. Newman, would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Oh, yeah. I'm Bob Newman. I'm the chair of the board of the Minnesota State Horticultural Society. And for the past decade, I've been involved with the society as an active volunteer at events, and I'm now serving as the chair, as I said. I've noticed firsthand over the last decade how the staff, the board of directors, and the members have been working together to effectively and efficiently provide the services that Rose just mentioned, and providing them just not only to our membership and the members of the society, but also to residents throughout the state, and as well as to horticultural-based businesses. And our presence is truly statewide, from our publishing of the Northern Gardener magazine and distributing those garden in a box, and our strong involvement at the state fair. You probably saw our presence for quite a few years. We had a very prominent presence in the middle of the rotunda of the horticulture agriculture building. We had a little white gazebo. We sold gardening books, horticulture books, gardening tools, and we had our presence there for selling memberships. We also sponsor shows and presentations at the state fair. A couple years ago, we were relegated away from that prime position. Our position was right next to the, what at one time, the wine wing and now the craft beer wing. And we were right between the women's restroom and the men's restroom. And we had a lot of pass-through and a lot of point of purchase. Now we are in a room called the dirt, and it's at one wing. And that has impacted our presence and our visibility, but we are getting around that with changing what we do. It's taken diligent and prudent use of both human and monetary resources to make all this happen, and as with any organization, we sometimes struggle to make it happen. We appreciate the state's continued support of the society during the past nearly century and a half. Over the years, the state's appropriation has ranged from being 30% of our budget to what's now just presently 2%, which is the $17,000. It has always been an essential part of our magazine publishing budget. There were 2 years in, I believe, 2004 and 2005 where we received nothing. And then some funding was restored after that. At this time, we're requesting the committee to reinstate the level of support to the former level of $82,000 yearly. The total request for the biennium then would be $164,000, again for the 2015-2016 biennium, in which we celebrate our 150th anniversary. This appropriation increase will continue to be applied to our publications budget, as noted on the revenue and expenditure graph. The publication makes up one-third of our budget expenses. These additional funds then will allow us to redirect some of our funds to other priority areas. And those priority areas now are upgrading our technology, which is essential, and to expand the Garden in a Box program. The upgraded, we need upgraded secure technology, and it's not only essential to just our day-to-day office operations, but also to all our program delivery throughout the state. Again, our mission is to educate, and this will help further that mission statewide. And we need to expand that successful hands-on Garden in a Box program even further statewide. The program is now dependent on grant support with an average yearly expense of $65,000. Most of the foundation grants are just one-year-only grants. So the additional funding from the state will strengthen the program's longevity and expansion. The Garden in a Box program also will benefit greatly from the upgraded technology. Now, as you ponder this request, I want to leave you with the thought that the Minnesota State Horticultural Society has a rich history of documenting the hows and whys of growing things in Minnesota. It all started with growing apples in 1866 and then showing and publishing the results of those growing experiments in the longest uninterrupted publishing of a Minnesota magazine. We ask your continued support in keeping the tradition of serving northern gardeners through education, encouragement, and community. And thank you, and if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer.
Members, do we have any questions for the testifiers? Well, I know it's my mother-in-law enjoyed being a gardener and was very involved in the local gardening. She's the green thumb, and she passed it to my husband. So I go home and have lots of wonderful flower gardens along with vegetable gardens. So,
great.
And I'm glad they do that. So anyway, but if we don't have any more questions, then, well, thank you very much.
Okay, enjoy thank your you. Magazine.
Good. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
There are membership forms to fill out if you feel so inclined.
Okay. We have Jaron Howe from Minnesota Dairy Association Dairy Development and Profitability Enhancement Program. I understand you're a grant recipient. So would you like to... have a seat and both identify yourself for the record. And
Jaron Howe.
And Tammy Howe.
Okay.
And I guess Dave Wine had asked if I would be available. Also, Jim Mulliner.
Sure. Thank you. Well, go ahead.
Sure.
Okay. Well, thank you. It may be a coincidence, but I actually served on a dairy profit team with Aaron and Tamara in my stint as an agriculture lender. And so I am familiar with them, and I think you'd like to hear their story. But just a few comments. I've experienced the dairy profit program as a regional director of farm management, and I think my area of west central Minnesota overlapped five different dairy profit team areas. And I had an experience as an agriculture lender for Heritage Bank, where I served on three profit teams as a farm lender. And now as a farm management instructor in St. Cloud, Minnesota, this is really dairy country. It's a learning experience for me, having come from southwest Minnesota, west central. Dairy is the lifeblood of Stearns County, Benton County, Morrison County, and parts south. But really, I've started there in August and have realized the land and the community is suited to dairy. It's not like we can stop dairying and go to row crop farming. And the towns are dependent on the dairy industry, the jobs. And so where does the dairy profit team fit in? The communities are made up of individual dairy farmers. The dairy profit team, it's actually run by the farm family. They decide to join the program. They form the team of advisors that they would like. That might be their veterinarian, their farm management instructor, their lender, community agriculture extension specialist, whoever they feel would benefit their farm. They form the team. They also set the agenda for the meetings that occur at the farm. And the point of the whole program is to help the dairy farmer improve. And it's really neat to bring a team to the farm so the lender can hear from the veterinarian, from the feed man. And so I would just say that in my experience, I've seen the program be very highly effective for those individual farms. And having been served with Jaron and Tamara, they can tell you their story. But that is just what I would say is it fits well with farm management. It helps extension. I'm not sure how many years the dairy profit's been in existence, but I'm thinking the late 90s is when you began funding this. And I think it's been money well spent because it doesn't serve, it doesn't educate a family to leave and go somewhere else. it helps them be effective in their community. They're staying there, so whatever help is there benefits that community. Madam Chairman, thank you for letting me talk.
Thank you. Would you like to tell us about your grant?
Sure. David and Jim had just asked us to share the story of our farm with you guys. We've been members of the DPT program for about 2 years now. A little history on our farm. My husband and I purchased the farm from his grandfather in 2011. And at that time, the farm had really, everything on there was 30 plus years old. He had not really done much for maintenance. And so we've been working with farm business managers, and they have suggested that we start a DPT team. My parents, I grew up on a dairy farm in Wilmer, Minnesota, and they had been part of the DPT program for about 8 years now, and they found a lot of benefit to that team, and I saw how it changed their farm from when we first started with the program to when Jaron and I started our farm. And so when we started in 2012, it's really for us. Since we've been part of the program, they've introduced us to just different options that are available in the industry, different grants that are available to help us become better producers, better farm managers, and be more efficient and profitable with what we do. It's a lot of work that we endure every day, and so being able to see the profit that we're able to do and the steps forward that we're able to make on our farm has been very helpful, and we accredit a lot of that to the DPT team. Since joining, we did we had, I don't know what grant that was called, but we applied to do an energy audit on our farm. So we had a lot of high utility bills and things, and so they helped us identify things that would save us money just from an energy efficiency standpoint. So since then, we've put in new lighting in our facility. We've used fans more wisely in our barn, updated some things with the equipment that runs our milking system, and that's been very helpful. Most recently, we received the EQIP grant that helped us fund a manure pit project, and so prior to that, we've been hauling out manure twice daily. And in this weather, it's really fun to do that. And so it's been wonderful this winter not having to do that, taking advantage of that new manure facility. And, from a labor standpoint, it's helped him a ton. I work off the farm, so the more help that he can get and the more labor efficient we can be, the better. And most recently, we just got word from Dave that and I received the livestock investment grant, which will help fund some of these other projects that we're working on to improve our facility. So this program's been wonderful for us. We really enjoyed it. And the team that we have consists of our veterinarian, our feed nutritionist, farm business manager, our lender, farm lender. Who else? Sarah Rorick, who is part of the DPT team. Brant Groon, part of our nutrition program, and so it's been wonderful.
Well, thank you. Members, do we have any questions for the House or Mr. Molinar? Yes, Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank you for pursuing your dream in the dairy industry. We need more people like you, and so thank you very much for continuing on in that industry.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. Any other members have questions? Oh, Representative Anderson.
Thanks again, Madam Chair. I see we have some time. So, Jaron, could you just tell us a bit about your operation, how many you milk, your crop rotation, what you feed your animals?
Yeah, we farm south of Hutchinson, about 5 miles, milk 70 cows, purebreds, around 200 head in total. We feed, raise hay and corn and and corn and then let's buy the protein and farm 200 and we own 120 acres and we rent an additional 100 from my grandfather.
One of the things that we've really found helpful with the DPT team and in correlation with our farm is my husband's farm has always been a registered herd, and so they focus a lot on genetics and pushing for nice quality high type cows. They like to show at the local fairs, go to the state fair, do all that good stuff. And but bottom line is we need to always make sure that milk production is where it needs to be so that we can cash flow and make smart decisions on our farm. And so that's one of the things that the DPT team has helped us is, you know, they recognize what we enjoy doing and why we're dairy farmers and doing what we do every day. They know that he enjoys going to the farm with the opportunity to work with really nice high-type cattle, but yet we're able to use the expertise of the seven members of our DPT team to help build on that milk production aspect, to help build that into our program and be better producers.
Representative Anderson, do you have a follow-up?
Well, again, thanks, Madam Chair. Just a quick one. How does this program work in relation to the adult farm management? Do they work together? Are you in both programs? And describe how those two would benefit each other.
Sure. They work very well together, actually. Our farm business manager, we've been working with him since we purchased the farm, a little bit before we purchased the farm, so in about 2010. And he's been wonderful. His name is Sean Meyer from McLeod County and works out of the Ridgewater College campus. And he's been phenomenal for us from a cash flow standpoint and everything. But what helps the team flow together is Sean knows most of the people in the industry that can connect us and make us a more strong unit as a DPT team. And so he's helped us suggest and build our team members. And really, it's been awesome. We meet with him at least every other month, if not more frequently. And we meet with our DPT team quarterly throughout the year. And so when Sean comes to our place and we have one of our farm business management meetings, we'll put together an agenda for the topics that we'd like to discuss at our DPT team. And I'll actually, we'll come up with some questions and assign homework to all of the members so that they all come to our team with answers to help us become more profitable. And it's anything from, you know, this year one of the top questions we posed were, obviously milk prices were awesome last year and it was finally really fun to be a farmer. and this year it's definitely declining. And so we've got to watch things a lot more closely. But one of the questions we pose to every member of the team, because we're able to see from a vet standpoint, from a nutrition standpoint, from a financial standpoint, how we can cut costs and save. And that was one of the questions, is just what would you suggest for us to be more profitable in 2015? And you get just an array of answers. And as long as we're willing to take those answers and move forward with them, that's what we've seen to be the most profitable for us.
Any other questions from the members? Well, we thank you very much. Thank you for coming and talking about your experience, and we wish you the best.
Thank you.
Much success. So, members, with that, we have the last business is the Minnesota State Poultry Association was not able to come and testify today. So, for our record, there's a letter in your packet that we will submit to the minutes. So that. I believe that would be it then. And so with that, we're adjourned.